From Interfaith Alliance, this is State of Belief Radio. I'm your host, Reverend Welton Gaddy, broadcasting this week from Monroe, Louisiana. State of Belief airs every weekend on radio stations nationwide and is available as a podcast on iTunes and other leading podcast platforms. I wish you would subscribe to it today. News broke this week that the Christian Broadcasting Network is launching a 24-hour news channel. They claim it will present news from a Christian perspective. But I guarantee the definition of Christian in this case is a fundamentalist, patriarchal, exclusionary, and odiously political one. The media market is already full of these voices. The quote-unquote Christians that appear on Fox News speak of faith and values from one very narrow and specific perspective. The hate group Family Research Council and its formerly David Duke Associated President Tony Perkins emit a daily national radio program called Washington Watch. It just goes on and on. Meanwhile, the kind of program that we strive to produce is almost unique in today's media landscape. State of Belief is made possible in great part by the generous support of our listeners. And we desperately need that support. If you've made a donation this week, please let me say a very sincere thank you to you. If you haven't pitched in yet, information on how you can help keep this show on the air is available at stateofbelief.com. That's stateofbelief.com. Let me say a great thank you to my friend Rabbi Jack Moline, president of Interfaith Alliance, for stepping up to fill in for me last weekend on State of Belief. This week, we're taping the show on Thursday, and so once again, it is impossible to predict what will happen to the Kavanaugh nomination in the time between now and when you hear our program. What won't change is the unspeakably cruel way the alleged president mocked the public testimony of Dr. Christine Blasey Ford in front of a rabid crowd in Mississippi. What won't change is the enthusiasm with which that crowd roared its approval, as if nobody in that room and nobody dear to those in that room had ever been attacked, abused, terrorized, raped by powerful and privileged men. What won't change is the way electoral passion among the Republican base has soared in the past couple of weeks, the way the SCOTUS confirmation debacle has inspired love and loyalty for the very patriarchy that has been exposed as corrupt and self-pitying and dishonest, and most of all, the very antithesis of the religiosity it claims as a mantle of virtue and legitimacy. And yes, I have heard many of the criticisms of how Democrats have handled this process, but I cannot begin to conceive of what I would be able to do if I were in their shoes. Do you? I still find myself having to come to terms with this sick new normal, with the acceptability, even the seeming necessity of cruelty, of mendacity, of rage, case by case by case. My heart instinctively waits for others to have the kind of repulsed public response that we have been able to count on among participants in civilization for my entire lifetime. And I wait. And by the time I realize it's not coming, that somehow this too, whatever it is somehow okay with so many of my fellow citizens, it's almost too late to respond. And by then, the next unprecedented outrage is already on the horizon. And in the midst of all of that, who's got the time to remember what happens? What always happens when society is reduced to the caveman level mentality of winning by any means necessary. Now, here's what's coming up this week on State of Belief Radio.
The large advantage Democrats held in enthusiasm has all but evaporated. 80% of Republicans now say the elections in November are very important. That's a jump of more than 10 points just since July. The Republican figure is just 2 points shy of the Democrats.
The midterms are coming. Just 1 month from now, Americans who have not yet been disenfranchised will head to the polls. But after what has seemed like 2 years of utterly unpredictable and inexcusable behavior on the part of many voters, is there any reliable way to predict what's to come? I'll ask political management expert Greg LaBelle.
Within, 12 years, we had homosexual marriage in this country. That momentary national awakening to the need for an almighty God turned into a nationwide fist of defiance in his face.
Boy, there's just doesn't seem to be any end to the ways the political religious right finds to bludgeon LGBTQ persons for short-term advantage. Demonizing, stereotyping, marginalizing, and always lying. But the harm done is very real. Among invaluable organizations working to create community support and healing for people of faith who do not conform to the religious right's purported values is Q Christian Fellowship. And I am looking forward to meeting co-executive director Isaac Archuleta this week on State of Belief Radio. But first,
our president has put the United States on a pathway of blessing, a singular pathway of blessing. We have the most pro-religious liberty president in the history of the United States, ever.
The drama surrounding the current Supreme Court nomination drowned out most every other story last weekend. But there's one too important to let slip. Late last month, thousands of social conservatives gathered in our nation's capital for a weekend of political Christianity-infused, paranoia-driven, and privilege-soaked speeches from guests that included, for the first time ever, the sitting Vice President of the United States. Of course, last year, VVS was honored by the very first speech from a sitting president. During that event was investigative journalist Sarah Posner, and I am very grateful that she is back with us. Sarah, welcome back to State of Belief.
Thanks for having me, Welton.
The Values Voter Summit is a pretty extreme venue to draw a president or a vice president. Would you briefly talk about why it should be controversial?
Well, the Values Voter Summit represents basically the core of the Republican Party base, white, conservative, evangelicals, and Catholics. Their agenda is pretty straightforward. They don't believe in the separation of church and state. They believe in the expansion of religious exemptions for people with religious beliefs like theirs. They would like to see the Supreme Court overturn Roe versus Wade and probably overturn Obergefell versus Hodges, which made marriage equality legal all across the country. So in that sense, their views are not in line with the majority of the American public, but they are in line with the majority of Republican voters. And so there we are. And there's never been a president in the history of the Values Voters Summit, which has been taking place since 2006, so since the George W. Bush administration, who has thrilled this movement as much as President Trump has. And in part because he is Trump's enabler, he's Trump's partner, he's Trump's top cheerleader, Vice President Pence, who has been a hero to this movement long before Trump came along, mm-hmm. was very warmly received at this event.
A hallmark of the political religious right is a constant posture of being aggrieved and discriminated against. Are they still able to strike that pose with a straight face, considering the dominance they've achieved over the levers of power?
Well, I guess it depends what you mean by a straight face. But I think that the reason why this movement has been so successful over many decades is because regardless of whether they hold power or not, they are very good at making it seem like everything hangs in the balance nonetheless. Mm-hmm. So, for example, I think that when Democrats or liberals hold power, they feel like they've accomplished something. We elected President Obama, for example. Mm-hmm. So they tend to overlook threats to the consensus that evolves around somebody like Barack Obama. Mm-hmm. The Christian right has a very different take on that, right? So, like, they're very happy that they elected Trump, but they're constantly on guard about enemies or satanic forces or political adversaries who might undermine that cementing of power. Mm-hmm. So even though they're very happy with Trump's rhetoric on their issues, they're very happy with Trump's policy changes, they're very happy with Trump's judicial nominees, including and perhaps especially Brett Kavanaugh, they still want their followers to be on guard for the possibility that this could all come to an end. It could come to an end in an election. It could come to an end if Democrats take control of the House and or the Senate. It could come to an end in the 2020 election. And so they're just always reminding their followers that they have to go out and vote. Nothing is taken for granted, and our enemies, both in the real world and in the spiritual world, are always ready to undermine our accomplishments.
What did you hear in the various presentations that might help us understand what the next goals of this theocratic movement are likely to be?
I think what's been evident not only at the Values Voters Summit, but largely, you know, in the religious right as a whole and in the Trump administration's actions, is the idea that the government should be protecting the quote-unquote religious rights of Christians whose conscience is being violated by things like legal abortion or LGBT rights. So I think that what the followers of this movement are expecting is that the government is going to continue to make policy that broaden the ability of people to object on religious grounds to those things and potentially opt out of having to comply with them. So think about it as the Hobby Lobby case, mm-hmm. magnified by many orders of magnitude. Mm. I think that also what they think is next is that Trump will continue to be president and Trump will continue to be Trump. And I think that in the long term, that that's a very alarming trend, because if that's what they consider to be a good or normal presidency, I'm not really sure what that means for future Republican presidents and this movement's willingness to say, hey, wait a second, you know, you've gone too far either in exercising your presidential power or evading the law, mm-hmm. or using campaign rallies or Twitter to belittle people or make fun of people or harass people. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot in what I just said, but mm-hmm. there's also a lot happening here.
Mm-hmm. Sarah, just walking around, what's it feel like to you?
You know, I've been covering it for many, many years, and you know, the people who attend, their views on particular policy questions are no real surprise, obviously. But there is definitely a circling around Trump that seems to intensify the more Trump comes under fire by, say, what they view as the fake news media, mm-hmm. or by, you know, the Democrats. Particular Democrats draw a very angry condemnation, boos, mm-hmm. and so forth from the audience. You know, mm-hmm. Nancy Pelosi, Hillary Clinton, mm-hmm. Kamala Harris, Maxine Waters, Cory Booker. Are you sensing a pattern here? I'll give you an example. A very easy, like, applause or boo line from the stage mm-hmm. was to remind the audience of Hillary Clinton's speech where she talked about the basket of deplorables. Mm-hmm. And I think it was pretty evident that in that speech, Clinton was talking about the alt-right, you know, sort of white sure. supremacist neo-Nazis who were supporting Trump during the 2016 election. It's interesting that the Christian right has really embraced it as, like, she was talking about us. So they really like to sort of say, oh, we're the deplorables. Like, how dare the Democrats view us, just patriotic, red-blooded Americans, as being the deplorables. And so that line, it's just like how much that line has gotten recycled to ramp up the hostility to the Democrats, and in particular Clinton, is really remarkable, you know, roughly 2 years later. The embrace of Trump and Trumpism, I think, only has intensified as opposed to the Christian right becoming more skeptical of Trump and Trumpism as his presidency goes on.
This week, the New York Times published an investigative report of record length, long-term probe of the president's family financial history. You wrote a piece in the Washington Post about the Trump prosperity gospel a couple of years ago that helps explain why no level of corruption is likely to weaken support for Trump. Would you just comment on that?
Well, the prosperity gospel has really pervaded American evangelical and Pentecostal churches in a way that I think a lot of non-evangelicals and non-Pentecostals don't really appreciate. I mean, I think that if the general public is aware of the prosperity gospel, I think they think of it in the most sort of extreme terms if they've seen, like, someone like Benny Hinn or Kenneth Copeland on TV, you know, somebody pressuring their congregants to give them their money, you know, sow their seed, or they've seen the news reports of somebody like Creflo Dollar pleading with his congregation to give him their money so he can buy a new luxury private jet. But I think that people underappreciate the extent to which this sort of thinking has pervaded evangelical churches, even when there's not such an extreme example of that kind of corruption. And so I think a lot of people sort of see Trump as somebody who's been very successful and has been blessed by God, because if you believe in the prosperity gospel, you believe that somebody's prosperity is a result of their faith in God and mm-hmm. God's blessing on them. It's not the result of fraud or corruption or theft or any sort of criminal activity. And another feature of this, and I know this from myself reporting on prosperity gospel churches and talking to people who used to go to prosperity gospel churches and then became disenchanted with it, is that news reports about how the pastor got rich, right? So, like, you'll have some pastor in some city and the local newspaper will do a story about the corruption within that pastor's church and how they got rich off of fleecing their flock. And, you know, now they live in a mansion and drive a Rolls Royce and have a luxury jet. And these people tell me that, you know, they so believed that anything that went against their pastor was the work of the devil, mm-hmm. or that the local newspaper that reported on this wasn't just not to be believed. And so, like, they wouldn't even read it. Like, they would know that the article was in there, but they wouldn't even read it. That's how convinced they were that anything that went against the pastor was something that was the work of the devil and or not to be believed. Mm. So it's hard for me to imagine that these hardcore Trump fans, including those who believe that his wealth is a sign that God has blessed him in some way, or a sign that his faith in God is so cemented that God has blessed him in this way, mm-hmm. that they would believe the New York Times, particularly after Trump has spent the last however many years lambasting it as, you know, fake news and the failing New York Times and so on. So, like, we're in a place where the facts don't matter. We're in a place where these three incredible reporters spent an unbelievable amount of time and effort reporting this story about the president of the United States, and we have a good chunk of the U.S. population who will just refuse to believe it.
Mm. Sarah, I know that the midterm elections are close. What are you keeping an eye on as we move toward those, and what do we need to be watching carefully as we go?
Well, I think what we're seeing is the Republicans want to make sure that their base is fired up, whether it's fired up because they want to protect Trump or fired up because they're angry about the way they perceive that Kavanaugh has been treated in the confirmation process. And so I think that it's really kind of hard to keep your eye on 435 House races.
Yeah.
And I think that all of those races are highly dependent on local conditions. But I also think that the Republican base is very intent on mobilizing its voters and getting them out there on these larger national issues as opposed to perhaps some of the local ones. It would be a mistake to rely too closely on these sort of generic ballots that show the Democrats being up, because these House races are very dependent on both what's going on in the district and the makeup of the voters who will actually go out and vote in each district.
Sarah Posner is an award-winning investigative journalist, author, and expert on the intersection of religion and politics. Her work has appeared in Rolling Stone, The New Republic, The New York Times, The Washington Post, and many other publications. Sarah is a reporting fellow at the Nation Institute and the author of God's Prophets, P-R-O-F-I-T-S, Faith, Fraud, and the Republican Crusade for Values Voters. You know, Sarah, it occurs to me that if more strategists and candidates and voters had read that book, we might not be in the mess that we're in today. Sarah, thank you so much for being with us again on State of Belief Radio.
Thanks, Walton.
There's lots more still to come on this week's show. We'll hear from political management expert Greg LaBelle on how radically expectations for the upcoming midterm elections are suddenly shifting. And up next, Isaac Archuleta of Q Christian Fellowship. It's the latest installment of our series, Whosoever You Love. I'm Welton Gaddy. You're listening to State of Belief Radio, brought to you by Interfaith Alliance. Another week, another senseless attack on the dignity of LGBTQ persons by the Trump administration. The State Department will no longer issue visas to the same-sex partners of UN and other foreign diplomats. That, despite the fact that the home countries of most such diplomats don't offer the option of same-sex marriage. Meanwhile, traditional defenders of the rights for sexual minorities are overwhelmed by the countless other indignities our government is hurling at vulnerable groups. And most disgustingly, the overt or at least implied context is always some version of so-called traditional family values. God protect us from those who espouse the values of contempt, hate, and divisiveness. Not waiting for divine action in bringing LGBTQ persons of faith together, offering community, encouragement, support, and blessing, is Q Christian Fellowship, formerly known as the Gay Christian Network. And I'm so happy to welcome Co-Executive Director Isaac Archuleta to State of Belief as part of our ongoing series, Whosoever You Love. Isaac, thank you for being with us today on State of Belief Radio.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Let's start with a quick summary of what the fellowship is all about and what you and your co-executive directors bring to that work.
Absolutely. The former name of our company, the Gay Christian Network, was the brilliant idea of our founder, Justin Lee, who wanted to create an online network of gay Christians. As a gay Christian himself, in his young adulthood and late adolescence, really, was very, very hungry to find people who identified not only as gay, but also as gay and Christian. And his online chat room in the early 90s evolved and grew and became an international network of people who identify as both gay and Christian or lesbian and Christian. And their parents actually started attending the conferences that we began hosting. Mm-hmm. With the change of leadership, the three co-executive directors and I are really focusing on fostering self-acceptance for the gay Christian community, what we call the queer Christian community. Mm-hmm. But also, we want to create a sense of community so that not only does that self-acceptance foster, but that as we begin to love ourselves, we can love others. And we believe that relational justice, the way that we love ourselves and others, is the bedrock for social justice. And the other piece that we really want to focus on is creating a sense of advocacy. How do we create spaces and safe places for people in the margins? So our work right now is international. We have an annual conference, and usually we have anywhere between 17 and 19 countries represented at our annual conference. It's in different locations every year. And right now, the two others, we have an incredible director of development who's in charge of fundraising. And we also have a corporate lawyer who's one of our co-executive directors who is just a fascinating operations wizard. Yeah. So together, what we're trying to build is strong resources that help people on the margins, particularly those in the LGBTQIA community and their religious parents, find safety, peace, and love, even if they disagree. So mm-hmm. as a trained psychotherapist, I'm really interested at maintaining attachments, even if we disagree. Mm-hmm. So we're in the business of fostering self-acceptance and creating safety.
I think some people might ask the question, why are you focusing on self-acceptance and self-love?
I'm going to start with this idea of shame. Shame affects all of us in very subconscious, subtle ways, but yet also in very overt, profound ways. What happens when we allow shame to stay in existence, when we allow shame to have presence in our own experiences? It actually begins to distort our identity into something that says, I am damaged, I am unlovable, I am rejectable. In Christianity, we have this, what I consider, this phenomenal concept that we get from Genesis, right off the bat in Genesis 1, 26 and 27, where it says, God created them in his likeness and in his image. God created them. And what theologians would extract from that is something called the Imago Dei. We are made in the image, Imago, of God Dei. So our image is all based on that we bear the image of God. And what shame does is it distorts that identity. So eventually shame will say, I am not part of the Imago Dei. Mm. And fundamentally, I find it fascinating or maybe even peculiar that Christians could say, people of the LGBTQIA community are not part of the Imago Dei. I see it quite the opposite. I think that every human bears the Imago Dei. And so to fight against shame is also to promote the Imago Dei in every human. And that is the job of self-acceptance, is to say it doesn't matter who you are, what walk of life you have, how brilliant you are at maintaining perfection, or how incredibly easy it is for you to make mistakes, you bear the image of God. And that is one of the most important lessons for us to really internalize if we want to watch love create a different world for us as we move forward as a human race.
Over the years, I have heard so many LGBTQ persons and allies say, religion is a soul-crushing, deadly weapon aimed at queer people. The only healthy thing to do is to walk away. So would you talk about why a community like Q Christian Fellowship is so important as an alternative view to that?
Absolutely. You know, when I was in seminary, I have a master's degree in clinical mental health counseling from a seminary in Denver, Colorado. Mm-hmm. And when I was studying there, I wrote an ethics paper, and I was so shocked when I read that a secular psychologist in a code of ethics was saying we need to help LGBTQ religious persons of faith detach from their faith as a way of embracing their sexuality. Mm-hmm. And as a seminary student, I was just floored because it diminishes the love that anyone can have for their faith. I was driving home from that seminary one day, and I was just so flooded by the messages of conservative Christianity that says I would be burned in hell, that I was an abomination, that I was disgusting or sexually deviant. And I internalized all of that shame. And I understand firsthand how religion can be used as a tool against any person who's on the margin, specifically the LGBTQIA person. Mm-hmm. I do think, though, that it's important for us to advocate for those of us who are people of faith to maintain their faith, or shall I say, integrate their spirituality and their sexuality, or their spirituality and their gender identity, mm-hmm. because I think it gives us the option of understanding the full gospel. Mm-hmm. If we say God is love, perfect love, not lust, but love, mm-hmm. can there be a righteous version of love and a sinful version of love? No. And so if we allow space for the LGBTQIA person to remain in the church, if we help them integrate their sexuality and their spirituality, the alternative is a gospel that evolves. It's a gospel that allows us to see the true extent of God's creative plan, mm-hmm. creating this wonderful spectrum of diversity in sexual orientation and gender identity that actually augments our understanding of God as love. And I oftentimes think that that scares people because they want to protect the narrow, focused view of God as love into this heterosexist container.
You alluded to the major conference coming up and mentioned it a little bit. I want you to talk about it a little more. What happens there?
Yeah, there's a lot. It's quite the weekend. So we kick off on Thursday evening, that would be January 10th, with what we call the Women Connect Retreat. So it's a dinner hosted specifically for women in our community to just bond and get to know one another. There's a keynote speaker. We cater the dinner. It's really fun. Throughout the weekend, we have four keynote main sessions where we pull in major thought leaders and theologians from across the world to come and speak to our community. Mm-hmm. We'll host approximately 36 workshops where people can dive into specific conversations about sexual ethics or how to come out to your family. The topics are wide and they vary, and we provide them specifically to help foster that self-acceptance. We also have Gunger, who's a Christian musician, who will be playing for us throughout the weekend. Mm-hmm. And goodness, what else? We have luncheons for transgender persons, for people of color, for clergy, for parents with children coming out, children in the community. So it's a great time of just kind of gathering together, sharing what we've learned, being with one another. One of my favorite aspects of conferences, the parents show up and they'll give out free hugs, which sounds kind of silly when you just talk about it, but to be a person who oftentimes feels rejected or exiled from their family, getting a hug of support and affirmation from a parent. It's just so beautiful to see, as well as, you know, doing the Eucharist or taking communion with other gay Christians. It's just so fun.
Once that conference is over and looking ahead at the year in front of you, what do you think are your major priorities?
Our major priority is to foster self-acceptance. I keep saying that over and over again because it's one of our main goals, particularly in this political environment where politics are really pushing back on our civil liberties, where mainline denominations are debating over whether or not people of the LGBTQ community should be present in their places of worship. So one of the things that we'll be doing is building an online learning school where people will be able to come in and talk about how do we integrate sexuality and spirituality? How do we overcome shame? How do we live healthy, long-lasting relationships? How do we maintain connectedness with our families and our parents who might not agree with us? So what we want to do is create an online learning school where people can come in and kind of have those resources, but also where they can spiritually journey with one another all throughout the year. So if you live in a major metropolitan city, you can have a devotional with your small group at home. Or if you live in a rural community, you can share in that same devotional process, and you can have an online small group, if you will. And so basically what we want to do is create a very, very supportive network of resources so that our community is just so reinforced and validated for who they are.
How can our listeners get involved with Q Christian Fellowship, and how can they support your work?
Absolutely. They can follow us on Instagram or Twitter. One of the best ways, I would say, is to hop onto our website and sign up for our newsletters, our devotionals. But I think one of the best ways that they can get involved is by registering for conference and coming and getting plugged into the community. I went to my first conference maybe about 5 years ago, and it changed my life. It was like I was walking into a massive ballroom with my brothers and sisters, like family that I had never known was out there. Mm. And so if anybody wants to get connected, that's one of the best ways. But they can definitely check out QChristian.org and get connected. They can volunteer. They can sign up for our newsletters. And they can join the online forums so they can start connecting with people all across the world.
One last question. And it has to be a succinct answer if you can. Why are you doing this work?
I'm doing this work because I was a young boy who was facing suicidal ideation and full of anxiety and panic and terror. And I went to seminary specifically as my last chance to give up on God. And what I found there was actually a life-saving message that I am loved just because I was created by God. And it changed my life, and I want everybody else who might be in those shoes to learn the same lesson.
Isaac Archuleta is Executive Director of Spiritual and Relational Formation at Q Christian Fellowship. Isaac brings a wealth of experience and insight to this role, with a background that includes work as a seminary professor and a licensed mental health therapist. Isaac, I really thank you for what you're doing, admire what you're doing, encourage you in what you're doing, and I thank you so much for being with us today on State of Belief Radio.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for having me.
There's 1 month left until the all-important midterm elections. So many of us who have been heartbroken, devastated, numbed by the torrent of outrages that have washed over America in the past couple of years seem to be holding our breath, waiting, desperate, for the better angels of our nation's nature to prevail. But what are the odds of that happening? With expert insights into our electoral environment, I am grateful to be joined by Greg LaBelle, who 4 years taught political management at George Washington University and has worked inside several presidential campaigns and is a longtime friend. Greg, welcome back to State of Belief Radio.
It's good to talk with you again, Welton.
What do you consider to be the determining themes for voters on both sides in November?
It's an interesting question, and I think to some extent, as I've been watching the polls over the last several weeks and months, actually, I think to a certain extent, a lot of this is locked in at this point. With the exception of this Kavanaugh thing, or some as yet unidentified crisis of some kind. It's hard to imagine a lot of shifting happening. There's a great deal of enthusiasm on the Democratic side, a little bit less on the Republican side. People are sort of locked in, particularly this is as often these first midterm elections in a presidential term are really referenda on the president and the president of the current presidency. So I think we're a lot of the way there. I was just looking at the current polls this morning, and we show consistent numbers that should give Democrats hope. As you know, I'm a lifelong Democrat, been working in Democratic president or campaign since I was 17. And, you know, I know that Democrats are quite capable of taking defeat from the jaws of victory in a lot of cases. So we have to temper it with that. But things are starting to get locked in now. We're getting very close.
Well, I think it's pretty clear that the Trump administration is expert at playing to its base. How about the Democrats?
Of course, that's been the topic of a lot of speculation over the last few months as we've gone through primaries and so on and so forth. It's difficult and probably misleading to look at this question on a national scale. I think we have to look at it on a district-by-district and state-by-state scale. And in some of these places, we have seen representatives of, you know, what one might call the Bernie Sanders wing of the party being successful. But in the majority of others, we have seen more traditional Democrats winning nominations. So I think it really does depend on the district one is talking about. I don't think there's the kind of outright warfare that some people would like to paint the Democratic Party in right now. I just don't think that it exists. As a referendum on Donald Trump, I suspect that Democrats are going to see that as their main focus on Election Day. And I think we'll see that particularly among suburban women, and I think, I hope, among some of the younger cohorts.
What would you like to see Democrats doing that they're not doing?
This really has got to be an effort at get out the vote. And again, in a state-by-state, district-by-district situation, I think it's going to be more important in some than in others. I'm not going to talk about national politics right now, but I think about the Georgia governor's race, Stacey Abrams, the African-American woman who's Democratic nominee down there. Mm-hmm. I think this can be an amazing event if Georgia elects an African-American woman as its governor. That one, I think, is going to come down to get out the vote. And I think in a number of these cases, that is what will happen. In general, I guess if I always get concerned about Democrats getting a little bit overconfident in the get out the vote area. We saw this happen in 2010, the first midterm after Barack Obama was elected, and all of these young people and minority voters came out and saw that Obama won the White House. But in 2010, Democrats kind of went, oh, we got these new voters now, we don't have to do anything about it. And that was as much as anything, I think, the big problem with that Republican takeover in 2010. So that's the thing I'm watching, that I want to see as much evidence as I can that they're doing that door-to-door groundwork on getting out the vote between now and Election Day.
Well, we obviously can't know how the Kavanaugh confirmation ultimately plays out since we're speaking on Thursday, but what has this entire process done to our nation and our politics?
It's hard to characterize it. I mean, we have seen the diminution of the United States Senate, of the United States Supreme Court, in ways that I don't think we ever would have guessed possible. The gamesmanship that we have seen, just from my perspective, the attempt to ram this thing through the Senate, which has been quite obvious in the shadow of the successful attempt to prevent even a hearing on Merrick Garland in the last year of the Obama administration, is just appalling. And I think it's very difficult for anyone to objectively look at this and say that this is good government. It may be good short-term politics, but it's certainly not an example of good government. I think that Kavanaugh has done himself a great disservice with his testimony. I think he showed himself to be primarily a partisan and a fairly thin-skinned partisan as well. So there are all kinds of reasons why I think if he ends up on the court, it will diminish his position on the court. And by definition, it will diminish the view of the court because he will be one of nine justices. And I it's hard to imagine any major decision that won't result in some reflection on Kavanaugh, his position, and how he got there, and the stuff we've learned about him along the way. And there's also the possibility that if he does make it, that if the House turns to the Democratic Party, the Democrats will continue to investigate and possibly consider impeachment proceedings against him. So all of this just keeps everything up in an uproar.
Talk for just a minute about Jeff Flake.
Yeah. I got to tell you, I was you know, glued to the TV that morning. Of course, the first thing we heard that Flake had came out, had released a statement saying that he was going to vote in favor of the Kavanaugh nomination. Mm-hmm. And I'll be very honest with you, I was actually in tears. Mm-hmm. I thought, this how is this happening to our mm-hmm. country? And then, of course, the whole drama that preceded the vote. And I'm glad he did what he did. I admire the fact that he did it. I loved his words about taking an opportunity to try to set ugly partisanship aside and do what's right for the country. And all that's very good. And I'm glad that it happened. But two things. I think what we're hearing this morning is the result of the FBI investigation may not do much because the FBI was so limited in exactly what they could try to accomplish in this short period of time and in the narrow focus that the White House apparently gave them. And I worry, I won't say I predict, but I worry that Senator Flake could see this as I've done my bit and end up voting in favor of Kavanaugh, despite the fact that there may not be any evidence one way or another that clarifies this. I could be wrong, but I admire his words. I hope that his actions continue to reflect what he said last week.
Are there any other voices of cooperation on this thing that could possibly come to the fore, or just wishful thinking?
No, the simple answer is no. We've got two things going on here that have an impact on this. One is more immediate, and that is obviously the elections that are coming up in 2018. But the more significant one, really, and I think, and this is why this has been such an important political event for Republicans in the Senate. In 2020, there are 33 Senate seats up for election, and 21, it's sort of the reverse of what we have in 2018, at least 21 of them, depending on the results of a couple of these elections, like the Flake election and so mm-hmm. forth. 21 of them are held currently by Republicans, 21 of the 33. So they'll be defending a lot more seats in 2020. The president will be at the top of the ticket for whatever that means at that point in time. But these guys are really afraid of being primaried. They don't dare move too far away from this Trump base. And so they're petrified that if they don't toe the line on this issue, and especially on this issue, that they'll be primaried in 2020, and none of them want to have to deal with that. So this is really, I think, sort of what's driving this thing.
When you answered me with a flat no, I just wanted to say to you, don't ever go into pastoral counseling.
You can rely on that.
one last question. How is the level of contentiousness that we're enduring right now likely to impact not the election, but our democracy?
Well, I think the biggest impact is on our democracy and not on our elections, although I think indirectly it sort of leads to the same place.
Yeah.
But we are at a point where we don't even know how to talk to each other anymore. And you know, I'll be honest with you, and this shows, I guess, and some would argue this shows just my own partisan leaning, but I think it's incorrect to argue that the fault is on both sides. Mm-hmm. I think that we've been heading this way for a long time. I think that what we hear people saying now is not new. I think the difference now is that with the experience of the Trump candidacy and the Trump presidency, Trump has allowed a lot of this language has allowed a lot of this language to be said out loud. People would never have said some of the stuff that they say out loud until he did it and sort of made it okay. I probably have said this before to you that, you know, when I used to teach my class on electoral processes, I used to lament to my students that there was a time when you disagreed in politics and in legislative politics and so forth. If you disagreed with me, you were wrong. I think thanks to the religious right and the rhetoric that they have brought to politics, the new thing is if you disagree with me, you're evil. And it's how, mm-hmm. I don't know how you have a reasonable argument, how you can even hear each other, when that's sort of the basis on which the discussion is placed. How does one argue about politics and policy in the context of eternal salvation? It just, you can't do it. But that's sort of where we are, and that's sort of where we've been brought. And it's taken on all kinds of weird sort of permutations over the years that's caused it to spread. And I am our democratic debate in this country will never be the same after this presidency. I hope that there is a swinging of the pendulum back, but he has changed, at least for the foreseeable future, the tenor of public debate in this country, and not for good.
Greg LaBelle is retired assistant of political management at George Washington University, where he continues to lead the semester in Washington politics program. Greg has deep experience working inside several presidential campaigns and has held leadership positions at Interfaith Alliance and other organizations. And Greg, thank you so much for being with us again on State of Belief Radio.
Thanks, Weldon. Let's keep the faith.
Now, before we go, over the past several days, I have heard words, seen actions, and confronted truths that I never expected to encounter where I live. Where am I? I ask myself, along with other pertinent questions, is the United States now a place in which political partisanship is more important than assuring justice? Can that be the President of the United States first speaking quietly about his respect for a woman who, because of her devotion to good citizenship, told the nation the heartbreaking story of her experience with sexual persecution? And then, in front of a raw, mean crowd in Mississippi, the same president shouting as if he wanted the world to hear him, mocking this woman, questioning her integrity, making fun of her misery, and speaking not one word of condemnation for the horrendous wrong and criminal nature of what happened to this woman. Is that how a president leads a nation? Have we given up on justice? Who will speak for the abused and demand punishment for perpetrators of sexual violence? Must women alone lobby for respect for their gender? Do people no longer weep in the presence of costly lies that hurt our families, fill our children with fear, and steal the pride that we once had as fellow citizens in this nation? Does anyone want to condemn damaging mistruths that can bring down our nation? How can we ignore the sanctity of human beings affirmed in our Constitution, and rather than protesting such barbaric behavior, praise people shouting, "Make America great again"? Personally, I am struggling with the hellish events of recent days. I've asked myself whether or not I'm upset by the partisan politics that turn people's heads from untruths, dehumanizing behavior, and elevating party loyalty over protecting the Constitution. Must every candidate for a seat on the highest court in our land be judged more by his or her political affiliation than by the person's character and honest devotion to the Constitution? From my perspective, this week is more about reality and morality than politics. Not the sectarian moral mandates of multiple religions, but the morality of common decency, the morality of searching for truth, the morality in which every person deserves respect, human rights, and justice. The brightest spot in recent days for me was the action taken by two United States senators, each from a different political party, who courageously stopped a fierce, divisive debate in the Senate Judicial Committee and called for a recess devoted to a search for facts and truth. Now, because of the power of one person in the majority party of the Senate, an investigation was ordered. Sadly, though, the consistency of the president's lies has eroded trust and left thoughtful and informed citizens trusting not even the judicial system nor respecting the work of the Federal Bureau of Investigation. Identifying the most disturbing comments from the past several days would be difficult. I'll not even try to enumerate even the worst of options. But one remark lodged in my mind and further opened my eyes to the serious crisis that involves a loss of integrity and the absence of courage. Senators Flake and Kuhn courageously exhibited the importance of values and the necessity of justice for everybody. Flake's troubled demeanor and quietly spoken words captured the troubling, dire situation in which they acted. Then came a moment that revealed the nasty power of partisan politics and its ability to shut down our democracy. Senator Flake was asked if he would have done what he did if he was running for re-election. With a smile on his face, he shook his head and answered negatively. Now, let me be precise. The senator said, "Not a chance. There's no currency for that anymore. There's no incentive." Do you hear that? Senator Flake undressed the lack of character in the leadership of our nation. Think about that. Flake had nothing to lose, he thought. But if he was going to return to his seat in Congress by election, he would have remained silent and not protested the lack of a search for facts and truth among his peers. Flake had told his colleague that what was going on in that hearing was tearing our nation apart. He knew the damage being done, but he would not have tried to find good sense, express empathy, and lobby for integrity if it was running for office. Not acting with the guidance of his conscience, he would have complied with the will of his party in fear of reprisals for not doing the right thing as his party defined it. We need not search long for what's wrong in our nation. Politics, partisan politics, is tearing us apart and compromising the most basic values that made America good, welcoming people from all over the world and assuring liberty and justice for all. When any one of us sees our nation coming apart and the power of partisan politics determining our character as well as our economy, I would hope that we would not only speak up in protest and immediately go to work not on making America great, but trying to make America empathetic, inclusive, just, and honest again. Without courage, truth suffers. And institutions like individuals establish the primal norm as winning. getting our way, putting down individuals different from us. When we live with the attitude of, this is what I want, this is what I believe, this is my team, this is my tribe, and to hell with everybody else, we oppose democracy and destroy the substance necessary for community. And that's regardless of whether that tribe is a political party, a religious denomination, or some other arbitrary division in what used to be a nation of compromise and accommodation. It's been a bad week. I hope you know that it's people like you and me that can facilitate change, that can make next week better and our nation stronger. We'll see what happens. Well, that's all the time we have for this week's show. If you've made a donation to State of Belief Radio this week, I want to say a sincere thank you. If you think there's value in the conversations we present and the voices we amplify in the midst of the gridlock our public rhetoric too often becomes, please make your contribution today. Find more information at stateofbelief.com. That's stateofbelief.com. Stay up to date by subscribing to the free weekly State of Belief podcast on iTunes or your favorite podcast platform. And take a moment to follow us on Facebook and Twitter and engage in the discussions you find there. Our producer is Ray Kirstein. State of Belief Radio is a production of Interfaith Alliance. Become a member today at interfaithalliance.org. And be sure to join us next week for more stories from the intersection of religion, government, and politics. Until then, take this seriously. Until then, you all take care of each other. I'm Welton Gaddy. That's State of Belief.
I think it's time we stop, children. What's that sound? Everybody look what's going on.